you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 175 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. And today my guest is Megan Xavier. And she was on the podcast a few weeks ago, but I've asked her to come back again because I wanted to talk to her about her practice area, which is fascinating. And to some extent, I think like this episode might be considered a public service announcement because Megan's practice area is she helps attorneys who are dealing with a bar counsel investigation of their practice. And if you're like me, the whole idea gives you the heebie-jeebies. And so I want to do everything I can to make sure that I'm never in that position. And so this conversation with Megan, I think, is going to help all of us understand what we can do to assure that we never come before the bar counsel. And in addition, we're going to talk about how she runs her practice remotely because she represents clients in California, but she lives in Georgia. So it's an interesting kind of twist there. So without any further delay, here's Megan Xavier. Megan Xavier, welcome back to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you.
Well, if that name sounds familiar to you, Megan was on the show previously, and not that long ago, just 10 episodes ago, in episode 165, she appeared with our friend Aaron Gerstenzang, and we talked all about the care and feeding of social media. But in the course of that conversation, I found it so interesting about what you, Megan, do in your practice that clearly I thought it was time for you to come on and talk just about Xavier Law and what you offer to the legal public. So let's start off with our standard question. Tell the audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Okay, well, that could be, like an hour-long question, but I won't let it be. what I do is basically I save lawyers' careers. I work with California lawyers who are facing discipline investigations and charges before the state bar court. And we work to get investigations closed and minimize ethics discipline for lawyers. And I didn't always do this work. I was a big law securities litigator for a very long time in New York, at least felt like a very long time to me, coming up on about 10 years I spent there. And then moved back to California and started working with other lawyers and never looked back.
What pulled you towards representing attorneys in disciplinary actions?
So in big law, you know how you can't actually help anybody in your real life,
right?
unless they're willing to pay big law bills. And so I got really good at that conversation when people would call and say, well, I'm really actually not allowed to give you legal advice. And I just hated that. And one of my close contacts needed some help in the state bar discipline system in California. And I sat on the sidelines for a long time saying, oh, no, I can't help. I'm an associate at this big firm and I'm not allowed to do that. And then I started helping sort of in the background, unofficially.
Sure.
And I watched the process and got very frustrated by how attorneys who were otherwise capable of handling legal work were struggling to defend themselves. So when I was no longer in big law, that case was still pending. And I jumped right in, whole hog, and took over and really enjoyed helping and helping colleagues and to be able to have conversations with the client where they actually understand everything I'm talking about because they're lawyers, right? You're not explaining what this motion means or what this means that we're in discovery. And I really enjoyed it. And once that case concluded, I had gotten the experience of sitting in bar court and watching self-represented lawyers struggle. So I started offering basically consulting services to self-represented lawyers. And that snowballed. You know, eventually I started taking on more full scope representations. And we moved a couple of times, including to Australia, where it was not possible for me to make in-person appearances. So I did almost exclusively self-help, helping the self-represented lawyers from there. And then it grew and grew once we moved back stateside. And, you know, I've gotten to where I am now, where this is a full-blown practice.
Wow. Are there particular skill sets or attributes or aspects of the law that you need to understand more completely in order to be able to represent attorneys before the bar? Or is this I'll just leave it at that. Is there?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I would say really that the number one skill is empathy. And that's way beyond what we learn in law school. But what I hear most from my insanely stressed out clients is that they need someone who will listen and not judge them and not tell them that they've made a mess of their career or they've really screwed things up, but will just work with them to try and solve the problem. So to me, that's the biggest thing. The other sort of flip side of that being the legal skills is you're navigating a system where the rules that you worked so hard to learn in law school and developed the ability to work through and use to your advantage in litigation in normal civil court suddenly don't apply the way you expect them to.
Really?
So it's tough. Like the rules of evidence, for example. I mean, how much do we study those, right? You take evidence class, it's on the bar exam. When you're an associate, you're learning that this horrible thing you think is going to happen. Oh, wait, this rule of evidence can change everything, right? These are like massively important tools. And then you go to state bar court and the rule actually says that the rules of evidence don't apply. You know, the rule, everything should be in. Basically, right. Everything should be in. The judges can figure it out. And all these tools that you thought you had, no, those don't apply. And even rules of procedure, you know, they're written, they're very clear. You've got 10 days for this and 4 days for that. But then you find in state bar court that 10 days expired and you went ahead and filed something on day 13 and nobody really cares. And it's really frustrating because you see it happen from the other side and you think, oh, I got them. You know, the big gotcha that in civil court, you know, like federal rules of procedure, federal rules of civil procedure, we know so well. Oh, that would be out. You can't file it on day 13 on the state bar court. Yeah, that's all right.
And so it's kind of a loosey-goosey. Really, it's kind of a loosey-goosey type of situation, which is ironic when you consider, you know, that it's attorneys looking over the shoulders of other attorneys. But I guess the argument there on the other side is that in the interest of protecting the profession, we don't want the people making the rules don't want, you know, people to slide as a result of kind of a technicality. They want everything to be considered, which I can understand that argument, but by the same token, fair is fair. And what's good for one side has to be or should be good for the other.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the justification is, you know, we're protecting the public by regulating our profession in sometimes draconian ways. But it is incredibly ironic that we work so hard to protect the rest of the world by using the rules and the procedures of our litigation system and for our entire legal system. And then when it comes to regulating ourselves, we throw those same rules out.
I would imagine. And particularly when you're talking about, you know, things that are oftentimes he said, she said types of conversations, you know, allowing anything to come in to consideration would be really frustrating.
Yeah, it is. It's very frustrating for the lawyers who have not been in the system before. Right. And they come in expecting those rules to apply and certain attitudes to prevail because they do throughout the legal system. And they've been using those rules for their clients for all the years that they've been in practice. And when they find it completely different, it's overwhelming and extremely frustrating.
Well, help educate me because, you know, but, you know, thank God I've not been down this road too far. I'm not going to say I haven't been down it a little step or two. But
most people have, sadly, if you look at the statistics, well, most of us have or will.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because I had a mentor one time told me that if you haven't received a letter from bar counsel, it's on its way. You know, at some point in your career.
It's not an unrealistic way of looking at it.
Which was terrifying to me. And when I got my first one, and I'll just in full disclosure, I will let you know, it was because I made a mistake with my escrow account. I deposited funds in my operating account by accident, as opposed to my escrow account. And then a check written against the escrow account bounced because there was insufficient funds. Perfectly innocent mistake. I just pulled the wrong deposit slip out of the drawer. But when I got that call and that letter from bar counsel, honest to God, my heart stopped.
Oh, I bet.
So let's help educate me. In terms of volume statistics, I mean, I'd like to think that the number is relatively low in jurisdictions for the number of cases that are presented to bar counsel and the bar association. Do you have a sense of what that number may or may not be, or is it as prevalent as some might suggest?
Well, if you look at California, which is of course where my focus tends to be, it's somewhere around 10%, not necessarily individual lawyers, but there's a number of lawyers, say around 180 to 200,000 active lawyers. We have about 18,000 bar complaints in a year. So it doesn't really necessarily mean 10% of lawyers had a complaint against them, because there will be complaints, multiple complaints against an individual lawyer, but that gives you some sense.
Yeah.
Now, as they progress, a great many are closed at the investigation phase. And in fact, some don't even make it to the investigation phase. So they first come to intake and intake looks at them. And if they don't pass the smell test, they don't go any further. So there are some that the lawyer never even knows the complaint was filed.
Sure.
You know, if they just go, this is bogus, and they toss it at that first step. But most will go to investigation. And then a lot of those will get closed at that point. And you're talking a much smaller number that actually get prosecuted. But if you're one of those, that's the only one that matters.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's the same kind of, funneling that you find in almost all litigation. Most matters get resolved one way or the other before you get to the crucial step of litigation.
True. It's like how many go to trial in a civil litigation.
Right. Do you, in your experience representing folks, do you see a trend as to what is the most common reason attorneys are brought before the bar? Is there something that, a lesson that we can learn from what you've seen?
Well, I'd say that although they add up to different types of ethics violations, at the base, a whole lot of them come about because we don't treat our clients very well. And that is something that, I talk a lot about on podcasts and to friends and at conferences, that why are we so awful to clients as a profession? And that I don't think that that's an unreasonable question to be asking, because if I look at client files, which I do like every day, right? Client complains, and now I've got the client, the lawyer is now my client, and I look at their files, I see how lawyers talk to their clients.
Yeah.
And I've taken over for other attorneys when a client has left them and come to me and looked at how my colleagues talk to their clients. And I'm like, what in the world? Like, in no other business would we think that's acceptable, right? The way that we treat clients, you would leave your cable company, your cell phone company, your cleaning person, your any other provider, any service provider, you wouldn't keep going to them. And yet we do that, and we expect to be able to charge our lawyer rates to these clients. And so if we simply upped our game in how we treated people, treating them with compassion, with respect, communicating with them, letting them know what's going on in their cases, delivering bad news when it happens instead of trying to hide it and tell them later or maybe never tell them. If we just treated our clients the way that we'd expect to be treated if we were on their side, I think that we would see a dramatic decrease in bark complaints.
That's really interesting. You know, the anecdotal comment that I've heard so often is that the vast majority of cases that come before the bar are as a result of failure to communicate with the client, which is a little different than, you know, poor communications or disrespectful communications. And of course, you know, the third rail of lawyering, and that's screwing up the escrow account.
Yes, the finances are also a major issue. Although a good number of things that go to the bar are like your mistake, where something went in the wrong account, something bounced, and then you explain it. And yeah, it goes statistically in that column, you know, of a trust account violation, but it also doesn't proceed to discipline. And I think, unfortunately, most lawyers are like you, their heart does stop when they see that letter, but it's actually fixable. The real problems are the ones where they actually take the money, go spend it on their mortgage, never do the work. And then it's time to refund the money because the client's like, hey, you never did my work. There's a ton of ethics violations right there. And they compound it with, oh yeah, that money, sorry, that's gone. And I don't have it. I don't have any more money to give to you as a refund. So those certainly add up to major problems.
Well, you know, in that, well, I was going to say you almost deserve what you get in that situation. But even in that situation, you're entitled to a proper defense from somebody like yourself.
Absolutely. And, you know, even though there are absolutely wrongdoers in the discipline system, you know, and I don't pretend every client I represent is an angel because they have made mistakes at times. There's still a system that's absolutely stacked against the lawyers it regulates. And that's a problem. It's a problem that if you go in self-represented and really unprepared, you can get snowed and end up with discipline that far outweighs what you did wrong. And there are things like mitigating factors that are actually enumerated in some states, and California is one where it's enumerated in the rules. You know, these are the mitigating factors we'll take into account and others, right? There's also other things. And there are things like community service and good character and, you know, length of time you've been in practice without discipline. There's a lot of things. Oh, and also very important, psychological or emotional difficulties, which can include things like physical illnesses and addictions. It can go, you know, the run the gamut there of things that are going on in your life that led to or contributed to your misconduct. Those are all really important in determining your level of discipline. But if you don't know this, the bar isn't necessarily going to tell you.
Right.
You know, someone may ask, you have any mitigating evidence? And you go, oh, I don't know. I don't think so. And they move on. And you don't actually know. There's a whole list of things you could be bringing in that could impact you. So those are all really important concepts to keep in mind when we have someone who's in the discipline system, did something wrong, but as they face what level of sanction will be imposed, they really should have the information so that they're playing with just as much knowledge as the bar counsel.
What role or where does the malpractice carrier, insurance carrier, fit in this whole process?
I end up having very little dealing with malpractice carriers. Every so often, a carrier will provide some ethics defense. And so, you know, we'll have some payment from the carrier or some reimbursement to the client for some of their expenses. But unless the underlying conduct that's leading to the discipline investigation also constitutes malpractice, so they need the carrier to kick in coverage for potentially a malpractice claim down the line, a lot of lawyers don't even call their carrier. And so, you know, even if they had some small amount of coverage for the ethics defense, most don't take advantage of it.
All right. So ethics violation is distinct from, in general, a malpractice claim.
Absolutely. So for example, I didn't keep my client informed, right? And there were some really important things that happened and I never told them. And, you know, I carried on with the case and I handled the litigation and whatever happened with the ultimate resolution. Now the client's really mad because they found out I didn't tell them some important things. Well, that's definitely an ethics violation. We have ethics rules that say you have a duty to keep your client informed of major developments, and the bar is going to be interested in that, and you might be sanctioned by the state bar for it. But it's not malpractice. malpractice would require that you actually did something to harm the client. First of all, there has to be harm, and you didn't meet the standard of the legal work being done. And so if you did everything you should have done in the litigation, you just forgot to tell the client important things. That's not a malpractice case. And so a client, the attorney's client might call a malpractice attorney and say, well, I'm so mad this lawyer didn't tell me this was going on. And malpractice actions are often taken on contingency. That malpractice lawyer is going to look at that case and go, well, that really stinks and your lawyer should have told you these things, but it's not malpractice. And so you're not going to end up with a malpractice action, but you are going to end up with a bar complaint.
Today, I'd like to introduce a new sponsor to The Law Entrepreneur, and that's the folks at Jurisdiction. You started your law practice to ditch the firm life and be your own boss, but your practice is running you. The good news, being an attorney entrepreneur doesn't have to be this hard. Jesse and Megan, the lawpreneurs behind Jurisdiction, are working to build a new generation of solo practitioners who love being lawyers. This year, Jurisdiction is introducing a new program, Next Level Law Practice. Next Level Law Practice is a rigorous training program that provides the tools and business fundamentals for estate planning attorneys to start and grow a profitable and streamlined legal business. Next Level Law Practice gives you access to videos, worksheets, templates, one-on-one coaching, and live group sessions that allow you to ask questions and learn on your own schedule. To learn more about the program, visit thrivejd.com. That's thrivejd.com. They're even offering an exclusive coupon code for the Law Entrepreneur listeners. Just enter the code TLE150, that's like the Law Entrepreneur 150, for a $150 discount off your course registration. And welcome to the show, Jurisdiction. Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. So let's, if you can again help continue to educate me, let's talk about the process here. So you're sitting in your office, fat, dumb, and happy, and all of a sudden you get a communication from bar counsel that somebody has filed something against you. And what are I know each jurisdiction is different, but in general, based on your experience in California, what's the process from there on out?
So you'll get that letter and it'll say, you know, we've received this complaint and this is what it alleges. Not so much you've been accused of, but that's how we tend to read it.
Right.
And then it gives you an opportunity to respond in writing. And that right there is the most important step of the whole process. You respond in writing with as complete of a story and documentation as you possibly can to show your side to the state bar and explain why this is not a case they need to pursue. That's the biggest chance you have of closing the whole thing, is that initial response. So that's really like my focus for everybody, is this is where we need to, you know, all hands on deck, get this response really well done.
And I've been stunned by stories that have been told to me of people that ignore that step.
Oh my gosh, so many. I can't tell you how many.
Stick your head in the sand and hope it goes away. Maybe they sent it to the wrong attorney with your name.
Yeah, right. And oh, gosh, I recognize that client's name too. Maybe he hired another lawyer. People do. They absolutely stick their heads in the sand and they really hope it'll go away, and it won't. And at least in California, and I suspect other states as well, failing to respond is itself its own violation.
Yep.
And so if you fail to respond and then they go out and they do their own investigation and you still come out on top, right? Even without a response from you, they still go, yeah, you're right. You didn't do anything wrong. Or we can see that you didn't do anything wrong. They could actually still come at you for a failure to cooperate charge for never responding. I don't see that usually happening, but it's just something to keep in mind. Like, that response is so important. And a lot of investigations get closed at that stage. I also, unfortunately, when I pick up a case later in the process, see a fair number of those responses that are really curt and not well thought out. They are the knee-jerk responses. You get the letter and you're like, oh, that's BS. And you quickly hammer out a response and send it in with no thought, no documents, not going through it well. That doesn't bode well. So if that doesn't get the investigation closed, you'll sometimes get a follow-up letter asking for more information, if kind of a second bite at the apple, which is good if you've screwed up that first letter. Or they'll go straight to, yeah, we've investigated this and we intend to prosecute you. And then you're in state bar court. You're in an informal conference trying to settle it before they file charges. And once they do file charges, it proceeds all the way to a trial.
So now, is state bar court, is that modeled on the criminal kind of approach or civil?
So California has its own state bar court that's a dedicated attorney discipline court, which is, it's the only one that does it that way. Other states, you're in you know, another court structure, a civil court structure. It's much more civil than criminal in terms of things like you don't have a right not to testify. Okay. You don't have a right to appointed counsel. So in that respect, it's more like a civil court. Although, ask any attorney who's been the respondent in one of those trials, they'll say it feels a whole lot more like criminal court.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see absolutely that being the case. Procedurally, it might be civil in nature, but it's certainly going to feel like criminal to me.
Yeah, and that's what respondents tell me. sitting at that counsel table, they don't feel like they're in civil court. They feel very much like they're in criminal court.
And the trial, if you get to that point, if you haven't resolved it by then, is a bench trial?
It is. It's a bench trial. And I believe that's true everywhere, certainly in California, but I think that's true in every state. I've not ever heard of an attorney discipline jury trial. So
yeah, you would think
a judge is going to hear it. And, you know, it's more of an administrative function of the court. And so some people will refer to bar discipline as an administrative court. I can see that. But then when I see clients who practice like social security law and it's truly administrative, I'm like, yeah, I don't feel like we're doing that. Yeah. Like that feels different to me. So I think it's much more like a civil bench trial.
And do you see the bar court as their mission being to protect the public or to rehabilitate wayward attorneys? Or is there a retribution element to the process? What's kind of the focus of the court, in your opinion?
Well, it's a good question. If you ask anyone on the other side, the judges and unfortunately I do sort of consider them on the other side, or the bar counsel, they will say their mission is to protect the public. And that's what it says on the outside of the bar building. And that's what it says on every bar website, right? We're out here to protect the public. And I do understand that to a certain extent. However, when you're knee deep in a case where you can see that the public is not at risk from a respondent, and they insist on some really harsh levels of discipline, it's hard to see that they are actually protecting the public in some of their actions. So although that is the driving force and the mission of the state bars, I truly believe that with the individual personalities involved in actually executing on that mission, that there is a level of punishment and retribution towards the wrongdoer attorneys.
And that's held up as an example for others.
Absolutely. I mean, this is public and they know. And even when this was on paper, and the bar journals were in paper, they already knew. And now they have websites where the statistics are undeniable. The most read piece of state bar publications is the discipline page. Everybody flocks there.
Guilty.
Right? Everybody does. Who did what wrong? And what was their sanction?
When I used to get the bar newsletter from District of Columbia, which had a really extensive disciplinary section, I wouldn't read anything else in the bar journal, but I read that disciplinary section every single month.
And it's the most visited page on the website.
I imagine. So, I had an employer at one point who told me that he structured his day with the idea that the first thought he was going to have in mind every morning was, what can I do to prevent myself from getting a letter and appearing on that page? He said, if I can get past that step every morning, the rest of the day was going to be good.
Oh, and what a way to live, to have that hanging over you every morning. But I get it.
It terrified me, but it made me think about all the things that I could possibly do incorrectly, including firing off that nasty letter to a client. It gave me pause.
As it should. I mean, this is an important part of our profession, and it's interesting how lawyers who find themselves in the discipline system suddenly reevaluate how they do business. Because they really think, most of them, that this is never going to happen to them. See, the ones who wake up every morning thinking about it are probably going to manage to stay out of it.
Sure.
Because they're actually thinking about it. The ones who end up in the system too often are the ones who never thought this would happen to them. And so in their practice, they're not being careful. And they are sending off that nasty gram to whoever. Sometimes it's the opposing counsel. Sometimes it's CCing an opposing party when they wrote to opposing counsel. And really dumb things like that, where if they stopped and thought about it, they probably wouldn't have done it. So if they had had that attitude that your colleague had first thing in the morning thinking about this, they probably wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. Oh, it's giving me all the heebie-jeebies here. Let's talk about something other than the disciplinary actions. Let's talk about how you manage your practice. So you live in Georgia, but your practice is in California.
Right.
A few years ago, that would have been an impossibility.
True. Absolutely true. But in fact, even when I started launching it, it was really hard to convince people and to make it work. But it's much easier today.
Well, aside from just the optics, why would I hire an attorney in Georgia to represent me here in California? Just systemically and technically, it would have been very, very difficult to do. I mean, I suppose you could do it by U.S. mail and the telephone, but I gather with today's technology, it makes it a lot more simple. I know my kids live on the West Coast. I live on the East Coast. And with today's technology, it's like they're living next door. I can't really tell the difference. And I suspect that's the same between you and your clients.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, actually, my daughter is 12 and she was just asking me how old I was when I went backpacking in Europe. And I told her I was 18. And she's like, okay, I got 6 more years. And I said, you know, I can't believe sometimes that Papa, my dad, let me do that. I look back and I go, oh my gosh, how did he let me do that? There were no cell phones. There were no video calls. Right. I called collect. I still hear about the $2,000 phone bill I ran up on his phone by calling collect from Europe for 7 weeks. And I said to her, I'm looking at her, I'm like, you know, I might actually let you do that because you'd have a phone and I could video call you anytime I wanted to. And so, yes, the world has changed so much that I tell people when I do every so often get the objection of like, well, wait a minute, you're there and I'm here. How is this going to work? Like, you know what? I could be down the street from you and you still would not need to come into my office. We would not need to sit down in person. I would not need you to hand me any paper. This would all be electronic anyway. So whether I'm down the street from you or 3,000 miles away from you, nothing is different about this representation.
And does technology play an important role in your practice, or is it just kind of a given?
It's really important. We work really hard in my office to streamline all of what we do through technology. In fact, my assistant lives in an RV and travels around the country. I'm never quite sure which time zone she's in. And she
That's putting mobile in the phrase mobile office.
Right? Yes. She and her husband both work out of the RV. And I think she's currently in Utah. I get really cool pictures from her. She's like, this is the office today. And she'll send me a view of where they are. And so even our own communication has to be tech driven. And it's more comfortable. I mean, it makes everything about our work and life and how we manage both together work better. So we really funnel everything into technology, from how we communicate with each other to automating client communication, automating how clients set up consultations. We have a really streamlined system for that. Clients book online, they receive an automated intake form, they fill that out electronically. I have all of their information before I ever call them, and I've reviewed it. Calendar reminders go out, text reminders go out, and we don't have to do anything. We sit back and, take our kids to the park while all of this is happening. So technology is a really important underlying part of my practice.
And you have online document signing capabilities and fund transfer.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it's so unusual to get a check anymore that everyone pays online. They sign their fee agreements online. I hardly have any paper. When someone mails me something, I'm like, what is this? Oh, okay, now I scan it and I throw it away.
I had an interesting happening last week. I was in a family law mediation, and I told the client that they had to bring a check to pay the mediator. And they said, I don't have a check. I don't have checks. And, I hadn't really thought about that. In my age, everybody had a checkbook. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, I asked my kids, and I said, "Dad, we don't have checks either." So,
okay. Yeah, I heard that there's the term adulting.
Yeah.
That people should have adulting classes. And one of the things that I heard from a friend was that under some age, in your young 20s, most of the people younger than that did not know how to write a check.
Well, that's what my son said.
They wouldn't know what to put. They wouldn't even know how to fill it out.
Didn't know how to fill it out.
Yeah.
Yep. So anyway, well, listen, Megan, this has been fascinating. I just so enjoy chatting with you and finding out more. I hope I never need your services, but and that nobody ever needs your services. But, I want to ask you one last question. I forgot to ask you this. Have you seen any change in or increase in the number of cases that you're dealing with that are a direct result of the influence of social media in the legal space?
That's an interesting question, because I talk a lot at conferences about how to use social media appropriately and not screw it up, because we have some poster children lawyers out there who botched it really badly and been disciplined. But that being said, and it being so prevalent that we are all worried about it, I actually don't get very many cases that are directly attributable to social media.
Interesting.
So I don't know if those are still to come, if regulators are looking for bigger fish to fry. I just don't know why that is, but lawyers are absolutely paranoid to learn how to use social media properly. But I just don't see it yet in the discipline space as a big driving force behind individual cases.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, again, I hope I never have to use your services, but if somebody does, what's the best way to get in contact with you or follow up on anything you've had to offer today?
So social media-wise, the best place to find me is on Twitter. I'm at Xavier Law, or my website, xavierlaw.com, is the hub of all things related to my firm.
Terrific. We'll have all of that in our show notes for those of you who are in the car on the treadmill. And Megan, I want to thank you again for being a guest today on The Law Entrepreneur, and I hope to have you back again sometime soon.
Well, thanks, Neil. I would love to do that.
Thanks so much. Well, that will do it for today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors for making this show possible, the good folks at Call Ruby Receptionists, and our newest sponsor, Jurisdiction, the providers of the Next Level Law Practice Program. So take a moment to visit our show notes and hop on over to their websites for special discounts and savings and other free stuff that you can get, and just support them because they make this podcast possible day in and day out. Also, if you got a couple minutes, pop on over to our own website, thelawentrepreneur.com. We have a couple little articles there. You can also listen to the podcast itself there if you choose to. And sign up for our newsletter or our mailing list. And we don't do a lot. You know, you're not going to bombard you with emails every week. And I do plan on doing a few more this year, but we'd love to have you join our community. And in that sense, you can also go on to our Facebook page. You can find us just by searching on The Law Entrepreneur. You can find out what we got going on a daily basis, sometimes hourly, on the Facebook page. So I'd love to have you join us there. And if you have the time, last but not least, go on over to iTunes, search on The Law Entrepreneur. And if it's something that you believe in and feel strongly about, we'd love for you to leave an honest 5-star review, as well as comments about what you like and dislike about the show, because it does mean a lot to us that you are our community, our listeners, and I want to thank you for making this all possible. So we'll see you next time on The Law Entrepreneur.